Today is Friday, February 17th, 2023. This is part two of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Charles Schulz. Charles spells his last name S-C-H-U-L-Z, and he goes by Charlie. And my name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Charlie. How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you, Tom?
I'm good, thank you. Charlie, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, you can.
Thank you. While the tape is going here, I want to tell you, Charlie, your interview last week really was food for thought for me about checklists and when things go wrong, the things we never train for. Would you mind to pick up the thread of your time in between 1966 and 1970 as a fueler for the Titan II missiles around Tucson, Arizona?
Yeah, I want to clarify that comment a little bit. I was actually a crew member, not a fueler.
Okay. What's the difference?
My position, well, on the crew, there were four positions. There's a crew commander who was usually, at a minimum, a first lieutenant, but quite often captain or a major.
Okay.
Then there was a deputy missile combat crew commander, and that was usually a entry-level position for an officer. Onto a crew, usually a second lieutenant at a minimum, or a first lieutenant, and on occasion even a captain, depending on what their route into where they were joining the crew. And the commander, in a sense, or in all reality, was the owner of the site, if you will.
Okay.
Every day at the changeover, the crew commander, when that changeover position was done, would get on the phone, contact the wing command post, and say, "I, Captain so-and-so and crew so-and-so, I have now taken control of site XYZ."
Okay.
And from that point until he was relieved, that commander was responsible for anything that happened on site.
Okay.
The deputy was primarily related to communications, but worked with one of the enlisted personnel. I'll go through the two enlisted people next. There were two of us that were enlisted people. We were... the first one was a missile facilities technician, and that person was kind of like the building superintendent, knew everything about everything from air conditioning to the heating systems to the all the filtering and all the processes, the hydraulics for several of the different operations. There were a lot of hydraulics involved. There were a lot of systems operated with air pressure and things like that, as well as the diesel generator. It supplied backup power if we lost commercial power. And so that person was a facilities manager, if you could think of it that way.
Yeah.
And the fourth member of the crew was the one that I had. And the title was changed over time, but it was ballistic missile analyst technician and responsibility for the guidance system and the missile systems themselves. So anything related to the missile, how it operated, as well as the guidance system and how it guided the missile, and keeping all that working and ready to go as it stood for what we or what was called a readiness. You were on alert, you were ready to be launched. In fact, the missile could be launched in about 1 minute.
Wow.
The message was validated, and that was a big change from prior systems. But part of our responsibility, and my responsibility directly, was to make sure we could do that, and that if something happened during that launch sequence, that our other part of our skills were to be able to work around whatever that problem was and hopefully still be able to get the missile to launch.
Okay.
So there was two parts. It was the part of it was the monitoring and making sure everything was ready to go and running daily tests and routines to make sure things were operational. And then the other thing is that if we ever did try to launch and we had a problem, to use your skills to try and work around that and see that the missile would still launch. So those are the four crew members.
Thank you for that clarification. That's because I had that totally wrong. Thank you.
Okay. And then the other part of it is that there was top secret material on site that was in a lock safe, and that was the information that was needed to validate a message that was received to tell you to launch, as well as the keys that were needed to initiate the launch sequence.
Okay.
But there were also top secret materials that were out on the commander and deputy's desk, which were message formats. So if a message came through, you had to open that top secret book and copy down the messages. Well, whenever you have top secret materials out, and this is the procedure at that time, I have no idea what it is this these mm-hmm. days, but mm-hmm. whenever you have top secret materials that have to be out in a open area where others can come in to that area who may not have clearance, you have to have armed people there. And so all four of the crew members were qualified to handle a 38 pistol. I'm not sure we'd want to fire it inside that room, but nonetheless, we're all qualified to handle 38. The two officers had theirs on while they were in the control center and on in the normal daytime activity. The two enlisted people, their pistols were in a rack close by, but they did not wear those normally because they quite often left the control center to go out into the area where the missile was and do verifications and checks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to have to put everything away and then get it back out, put everything away. So it was basically stowed in the control center, and it would have only been brought out or taken off or put on, I should say, if there was some threat from external that we had been warned about or, you know, said be prepared so we would be able to arm ourselves.
So hang on, Charlie, I'm gonna ask a question here. There are four of you here. There's two officers, and as you say, there's two technicians, if you will, two enlisted people.
Right.
And those four people all have top secret clearance.
That's correct.
So what would be the problem with having the book with the codes on the table?
It wasn't because of us, because we all had the authority to open those books and copy down the message.
Right.
So that wasn't the problem. The problem was we had a person who came in 5 days a week who was considered to be the maintenance supervisor for the site. That person did not have to have a top secret clearance, did not have clearance to access any of that information, and had a desk in the control center. And that person's basic responsibility was, it was like a five a 9 to 5, about 9 to 4 type job for them to do the paperwork associated with here's a problem, we got to get somebody out to fix it and things like that. The crew did not fix anything normally. The exception being if there was something wrong during a launch sequence and we could work around, then we would fix it with a workaround. But the site is full of duplicated equipment. So we didn't have one air compressor. We had four air compressors.
Oh, wow.
We didn't have all the hydraulic systems and things like that. A lot of them were duplicated.
Okay.
So there were all kinds of things in there that we could shut one down, or part of the daily routine was to move one system over to the other system. So, they didn't have all the hours racked up on just one system. So
that makes sense.
As a result of that.
Yeah. Pardon? That makes sense.
As a result of that, there were items that always had to be, some of them were hours. The meter would read up and it would say, this has got 10,000 hours. We need to have this maintained. Okay. The crew didn't get involved in that. That was maintenance people. So they were called, and this person that was there on site would call the maintenance control people, and he would tell them, I'm site XYZ, and I have a compressor that needs to be cycled that's on this 10,000 hour or whatever, and then would arrange with those people to get the maintenance people to come out and do that work.
Okay.
Now, as far as the crew is concerned, our only job was to monitor them to make sure they were doing what they were supposed to do and weren't doing anything else.
Okay.
But we did not normally get involved in, any kind of changing belts or anything else unless it was critical to keep us on alert at a particular time. So if it was like 2 o'clock in the morning and, all the belts were off, all the compressors and one of them had to run, we would go down there and we would try to get it fixed and get it to run. But there was still, when that person came in the next morning, we would have written it up and told them, look, you got to get somebody out here to fix this. This is what the problem is, and so on. And that would be their responsibility from that point forward.
Okay.
So our job was to only do things that were related as a crew member, only related to keeping it on alert. So that was our sole responsibility, keep this thing on alert and be able to launch it if the time ever came.
You mentioned
so to that end,
that it would take maybe a minute to actually launch unless something happened, and you were trained to expect what might fail. Can you tell me a couple examples maybe of what that training was about? What could fail, and how would you work around it?
Oh, well, I can't go into the details, partly because I don't remember that well
anymore. Mm-hmm.
60 years ago.
Yeah.
But we were trained, for instance, if there's a big door on top of the silo door, and it works with a combination of nitrogen and hydraulics. And if the door failed to open completely or open partway, or maybe it unlocked but didn't roll back,
right,
then we knew how to go up and actuate bells manually that would cause, if there was enough stored pressure in the nitrogen tank, to still open it even without our full power, electrical power.
Huh.
So we could get that thing open and then get back in and reinitiate the launch and get the missile to launch and have that door open.
Okay.
There were things like the missile was hanging on huge springs, but when you went to launch it, it had to lock those springs into place so that it had a solid base to launch off of.
Oh. Well,
if those didn't lock up properly, we knew how to go down and cause them to be locked manually.
Hmm.
So we could go down and lock those and then go back up to the control center and proceed the launch sequence that way.
Okay.
So that's just an example. There were things, mm-hmm, in the electronics part associated with, there's a launch sequencer, and that sequenced various events that had to occur in order for the missile to be launched. For instance, one of the sequences would be to open the door. Well, it also had relays and things like that that reported that status back to the control center.
Okay.
So if we got an indication that the door was open, one of the first troubleshooting things was, is it right? You know, is it correct? Did the door really open, but the relay didn't trip, or whatever didn't trip, so that, you know, it's a false indication,
yeah,
to us. So,
yeah.
But the electronic side, we also would be able to troubleshoot, you know, things like that. And in some cases, again, be able to jump around an indicator in that case to continue the sequence and make it continue through and go ahead and launch.
Okay.
So all of our responsibilities related to keeping it ready, and if it ever came to launch, to do everything we could to get through that process.
Did you ever, during your service, were you ever in a silo to launch a rocket without a nuclear warhead on it, just to see what that was like?
No, well, I wish I had. There were people, I'll go through kind of a back up for a second, give you a description. Every year, over the time, this missile was in service about 21 or 22 years.
Okay.
And over that, every year, they would at random pick a missile from each of the three locations. Tucson, Little Rock, Arkansas, and Wichita Falls, or Wichita, Kansas.
Okay.
And they would then have the people whose job it was to go out and unload the fuel off the missile, pull the warhead, pull the missile out, take it to Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, reinstall the missile, put the fuel and oxidizer back in, put a dummy warhead on it with a tracking and package that they could check telemetry and all those kind of things. And then they selected crews, real crew members and real crews, to go out there and pull alert just like they would be normally. And they would, usually it was only about a two-week time period. During that two-week time period, once it was ready, they would get a message just like it was real. They would copy down the message. They would authenticate. If it was a good message, they would get their keys out, turn the keys, and launch the missile. And the missile went out over the Pacific Ocean, and the reentry vehicle with the warhead would come back down to an area called Kwajalein, which is an atoll out in the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
And it was two-part thing. For one thing, they were constantly making engineering changes and modifications to improve the product. So improve the accuracy and things like that. So they, once they did that, they wanted to be able to test them. And the best way to test them is do one of these launches. So that's what they did. And they had three of these sites at Vandenberg. So they were always refitting one. They had one ready to go, and they had another one that was, you know, somebody was bringing a missile out, getting ready to go. So they had three sites out there that were constantly rotating and three or four launches a year over the 20 years.
Wow.
So it was not just one time that they did it. They did it routinely. And the other part of it is that the Soviets at that time would have trawlers, fishing trawlers, off the coast of California.
Oh, wow.
And they would have fishing trawlers off the coast off Kwajalein.
Okay.
And we made sure they knew what we were doing and when we were going to launch. And so they knew, and it was part of the game. It was, we're going to show you what we can do to you if you attack us.
Huh.
And we would launch the missile, and they would track it, and they would track the reentry vehicle, and they knew how accurate the missile was. They knew how far it could go, but that was all part of the game. It was part of, you know, how do I know you can do this?
Right, verification.
And so for us, it was, you know, training for crews. It was verification of the process and the procedures.
Mm-hmm.
It was made upgrades and changes were being verified through this process. Midway, about 10 years after the system had been up, they changed the guidance systems and they upgraded the electronics in the guidance system and significantly reduced the weight and everything like that and increased the accuracy. So one of the things they wanted to do is see, okay, does that work like the other one did? And so that was part of the process to, you know, put that new one in a few missiles and fire it and see what happens. So that was all part of the thing with also, as I mentioned, with the Soviets, hey, we'll show you what we got. And, you know, not going to be a standoff. If you do something, we're going to retaliate.
Right.
So it was, you know, we always, you know, we got classified briefings before we went out quite often. And it was usually, we launched such and such out of Vandenberg Air Force Base. And it came down within so many yards of target at
XYZ. Within yards.
And when you're destroying 900 square miles, being off by a couple of yards is not a
That's okay. A big but, deal. But I mean, going that far to be yards off, that's just really amazing technology.
Yeah, you're talking 5,000 miles or so. And today, I know a lot of the systems rely on satellites, which is a little bit troublesome, I would think.
Yeah.
And I would hope, I'm not at all privy to anything else, but that there is some way that if the satellites are knocked out, it's still capable of doing its job if it had to. But I don't know anything about that. I'm not
I mean, you would think that to be, it's an interesting discussion, sort of the end of the world, at least it'll still get to the target on, GPS. Well, that's satellite-based, isn't it? So, yeah, in a way, you would need a fallback system. Huh. Interesting.
So, anyway, in the command posts, in the control center, so there were always two armed people in there at all times because of the documents being out. Excuse me. At around 6 or 7 in the evening, one officer and one enlisted person would go upstairs and go to bed for a while.
Okay.
And the other officer, another enlisted person, would stay in the control center. And while they were there, the other part of the control center was that there was a two-man policy throughout the complex. But in the control center, not only was it a two-man policy, it was called the no-lone zone. So you could not be in the control center by yourself. There were always two people there together.
Oh, wow.
And while they had an active warhead on a missile on the site, one of those two people had to be an officer. So it couldn't be the two enlisted people. It had to be an officer at a minimum and one other person, either the other officer or an enlisted. So at night or early evening, two of us would go to bed for a while. And then around midnight, 1 o'clock, we'd come down and the other two would go up. And then the next time we'd be out, we'd switch off who went to bed first and stuff like that. But it was a very noisy environment, so you didn't really sleep much. It was they did measurements over the years. They did do some things to try and reduce the noise. But the noise level was equated with a lawnmower.
Oh, wow.
As far as, constantly, you know, all the time. So
that noise?
Well, you know, early on, electronics, like in this case, were powered with 28 volts DC, so they generated a lot of heat. And so there were fans and air conditioning and filters all the time running to keep all that stuff cool. And then there was a device called a motor generator down on level 3 that provided a stable 120-volt AC power, and it had a constant line, like just constant. It never went away because it had to supply a very specific 60 cycles, 120 volts AC, highly regulated power to the guidance system in order to keep the gyros and everything stabilized.
Huh.
So it's a critical piece of equipment, had to run all the time. And that was one, if it went down, I mean, that was a big deal. We had to get people out and get that back up really fast. But it was one of the sources of noise. The other thing were the radios. We had redundant communication systems that were going all the time to do communication checks. Because part of the problem is the system doesn't work, and if you can't get the message to the crew to tell them to launch.
Right. Okay.
So they had redundant systems. They had an HF radio system. They had a UHF radio system. They had a VHF radio system. They had a very low-speed communication system.
Wow.
And I'm trying to think what the other, there were two more. Anyway, there were six in total communication systems. And some of them came across as hard copy on paper. Some of them came across as a little ticker tape. Some of them, most of them, though, came over as voice over the radios. So you'd hear a voice, and it would say, this is so-and-so with a radio check. Acknowledge now. And at each complex, there was a button that you pushed when it said acknowledge now. And that went back to a panel at the command post at Davis-Monthan. And up on the panel, all 18 sites had a light. And when they acknowledged, those lights would light up. And they, in turn, would excuse me, would push a button, which went to 15th Air Force. And all their commands, all their wings would light up their lights. And when that was done, they would push a button and went up to SAC. And that was the way that they verified that everybody got the message and everybody acknowledged. And it went back all the way to Strategic Air Command headquarters. Above that, I'm not sure if it went to the president or the head of the Air Force or whatever, or the chief of staff for the military, whatever. But in any case, it was a way of making sure, verifying up and down, this communication worked. And that was done randomly once an hour.
Oh, wow.
So you didn't know when it was coming. It could have been, you know, last one was 5 minutes or after the hour, and next one wouldn't happen until 30 minutes before the hour, and then they might be 1 minute before the hour and 2 minutes after the hour. So
it sounds like when two guys would go upstairs to go to bed, say 6 or 7 in the evening, the other two guys wouldn't just, like, whip out the checkers. I mean, it sounds like you guys were busy all the time.
Well, it's funny. What you consider busy. I mean, you were down there monitoring this stuff, but we did have a table that we could turn away from, not away from the consoles, but we could move to the table, and we could play cards, and we could do other things. But we hear a message, and it's kind of like, I don't know if you've been in the environment before, but you have two or three radios in a room, and you kind of know which one is, where the signal, what the noise is coming from. And if that noise changes, you get up and what was that, you know?
You deal with it.
If it comes on a paper copy, there's a big ka-chunk and an alarm goes off. You go over and pick it up and look at it and hit the button. Or, you know, the other one, it was a punch paper noise thing that made a lot of noise. So whenever anything came through there, you heard it. And even though it was a noisy environment, that just added more noise to the environment. But it was, when as a side note, I moved from there into the command post for a while. And in the command post, you know, once or twice a month, there would be a message that failed to be acknowledged. Now, you couldn't send your acknowledgement up to the wing command post until you found out what was going on.
Right.
But as soon as that went more than a couple seconds beyond what we expected, we were on the phone, and generally what had happened is that two of them out there had kind of dozed off. And it was, you know, hey, guys, pay attention, wake up, hit your button. And so, that is just, again, a matter of you get used to things. Mm-hmm. Things happen the same way over and over and over again. And
got it.
It. Sometimes you get bored.
So even if it was loud, you guys would know the different sound types and clue into that. So you could, you know, play some checkers or a game of cards or take a nap.
Yep.
But taking a nap was risky if you were both sleeping. Then right. When something happened, if you didn't catch it somehow, then, yeah, somebody was going to call.
It was. I mean, we were going to call right away and try and rouse them. We weren't going to call the wing commander and say, hey, they're asleep out there, that's for sure. But
right.
You did want them to know that you knew something was going on and don't let it happen again, at least when we're around. So.
Got it. Yeah. Gosh, that I would think that's actually pretty difficult because it could be terribly boring, but you can't go to sleep, you can't read a book, you can't drift off too much.
Well, it was, I've been to, now the systems that are out there now are called Minuteman.
Okay.
And there's a site up in South Dakota that you can go visit.
Huh.
And, their environment is quite a bit different than what ours was. We were in inside of essentially a three-story building that probably had 1,000 square feet or close, maybe not that, maybe 800 or 900 square feet on each level.
Okay.
So it was, and upstairs was a bedroom and a bathroom and a kitchen. And then the second level was the control center. And then the bottom level was power and air conditioning and radios. So we had a three-story building, in effect. In the one where the Minuteman is, they actually sit in a capsule that's about, without equipment in there, is probably 15 feet by long, and then it's a round tube that's about 10 feet in diameter. And when it's active, it's got quite a bit of equipment, and there's really just two chairs and a small area where one of them can lay down to sleep. And then they have a toilet like you find in the prison cells, you know, with mm-hmm. a little basin on the top. And there's not even a door. You just pull the curtain around to right. use the facility. And they're in there for 24 hours, and they can go longer if they're snowed in at their particular location. Now, the upside is, they have a cook up top side in a little house who will cook them whatever they want to eat, and he can get that down to them and things. But they're in a much more claustrophobic environment, and again, it must be very difficult to stay focused in that kind of situation. We could get up and walk around. You know, the most they can walk is back and forth, you know, a few steps each way.
Wow.
We could walk around. We, when all four of us were in there, it wasn't unusual for us to, you know, pitch pennies, do all kinds of things just to do something different while you were there.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, that I'm just 15 feet by 10 feet, two people, 24 hours. That's, that's close to prison.
Yeah.
Wow. That seems very, very odd that they would design that without sort of thinking about, you know, to keep crew comfortable. I guess you don't want them too comfortable so they doze off, but you want to keep morale up. You want to keep spirits good. Fascinating.
Yeah, the human engineering aspects of some of these things go back some time, though, because that system, that first system of Minuteman 1, went on into service the same year that the Titan II did in 1963. Hmm. They're now up to Minuteman III, and they're now modernizing that force and going to another, it's not going to be called Minuteman, it's going to be something else. But to my knowledge, which I don't have a lot of at this point in time, they didn't change that environment all the way through Minuteman 1, 2, and 3. And I don't know if they're going to change something with what they're doing right now or not.
Huh. Interesting. Well, like time marches on, technology marches on, but boy, it sure sounds like it's a...
Well, you know, the government's kind of behind a rock and a hard place, too, because so many people don't want to give them money to do anything. So,
right.
You know, a lot of times equipment is old, It isn't the latest state of the art.
Right.
It doesn't get upgraded. You know, you don't throw out the old and bring in brand new because that costs a whole bunch of money. Can't you just fix what you got? And that's, you know, when they changed the guidance system out on the Titan II, it was because there was such a jump in technology during the 70s and 80s as far as, you know, the size of the circuits shrinking down and all that kind of stuff, that they could no longer get components for a system that was designed in the early 60s by 1971, 72.
Right. You were there during the days of tubes.
Yes. Well, it was all solid state in the 60s. They were, that was one thing. When the earlier systems, they did use vacuum tubes. When they went into doing the Titan II guidance system, they were one of the first innovators to put in transistors. But, you know, it was in a lot of cases, a single transistor would be, have a big heat sink on it. It might be a 2-inch square.
Oh, wow.
Where today in the 2-inch square, you get, I don't know, 10,000 transistors or something like that.
An old computer in that space.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Your watch was more powerful than what the guidance system was at that time, or the computing system.
Right.
And as the system aged, of course, components are going to wear out, and you go back to the manufacturer and you say, hey, I need some of this. And they say, well, we don't make those anymore. If you really want us to retool to make that up, it'll cost you, you know, umpteen million dollars for us to retool. And then so they found it cheaper to go and get another technology, another guidance system that was used in a later missile system in the Saturn, and they upgraded that and then put that into the Titan and replaced all the old ones with the new ones. But that was an exception because they could no longer get the supplies or the products they needed to maintain the old one. If they could have, they would have kept the old one. They would have never changed it.
Hmm. What makes the 21-year service life? What happens at year 22? I mean, is it because I would think that a missile in a silo is fairly clean, fairly protected, and can sit there a long time. What makes that service life?
Well, there's a couple of components. The missile itself, the fuel and the oxidizer, were both very caustic, if you will.
Yeah.
And they sat inside of a huge aluminum tank. And over time, just the deterioration of the skin and so on, you would start to have small leaks in some of those. And, of course, you don't want that to happen. The oxide was nitrogen tetroxide, and a little bit of water with that, it turns into one of the components is nitric acid.
Oh, okay.
Which will dissolve cement and things like that. So the missile itself, in that respect. The other thing is heat. All the components for the guidance system and all the things that are part of the flight package in the missile are on all the time. And just the heat, the fact, even though there's an air conditioning tube from outside connected to the missile into that flight bay or where the flight equipment was, over time, just because it's on all the time, that is going to deteriorate. Solid-state devices can last a long time, but if they're powered up all the time, they will, over time, start to fall apart.
Degree.
Now, outside of that, the equipment area, you know, air conditioners wear out. Valves wear out over time. And, again, those are operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're not shut off. Especially here in Arizona, the air conditioning systems ran much more than they did in some of the other parts of the country. But in the other parts of the country, they had heaters going.
Right.
To try and keep the things, you know, heated as well.
Right.
They had big problems in Little Rock with water because the water table was so high.
Ooh.
Water was leaking in all the time. So they had to have pumps running all the time. Pumped the water out.
Yeah.
Wichita, Kansas had a similar problem, but not quite as bad. And water, just the moisture in the air, they had to put in dehumidifiers to reduce the humidity because they were seeing equipment rust well before they expected it.
Oh, wow.
And so there's a constant program of cleaning the rust and paint, priming and repainting things just from that. Situation.
Yeah, I think of a facility in Arizona. You know, it's dry, the humidity's low, the water table's way down there, and But yeah. It gets hot in the summer, and so you gotta keep it cool. And as you say, electronics that are turned on, whether they're in Kansas or Arizona, you know, they degrade over time. So yeah, okay, right. All right.
And these are today's solid state stuff all works at microvolts and stuff like that. This was a system that was still running at 28 volts DC.
Whoa, that's a lot.
Was carried over from aircraft to missiles. At the time, you know, that's what they knew, that's what they used, and they used it with tubes and things like that. So why should I change it if I'm going to solid state? So they didn't. They used 28 volt DC, and then they transformers and stuff like that to bring it down somewhat, but there was still, and that's just that much generates a lot of heat on its own. And then you had everything to cool it. You had fans and filters on every equipment bay on two levels running constantly to keep air flowing up to those electronics for the radio communications and all the other communication systems, as well as through the equipment for the launch sequencer, the power management, the guidance system, and all those things that were in the control center.
Charlie, when I think of Tucson, I think of mostly blue skies, clean air, monsoons come in, nice puffy white clouds, rain, storms. But occasionally you'll get those hubbubs, the big walls of dust blowing across these big valley floors. And I would think that would be very detrimental to a system like this, which needs to be fairly clean all the time.
Now, they did have pretty good filters in the systems, but you could tell that the biggest thing was power outages. At that time, there was, especially in the 60s, there was a lot of above-ground power distribution, Abu would come through and boom, you lose power. And you may be down for an hour, you may be down for 30, 40 hours. Well, during that time, you're on a diesel generator.
Yes.
And those things, even though they went through a process of exhausting it and everything, it still just hung in the air, the odor, you'd smell it, and the oil and everything else involved in it. So as much as they tried to keep that environment clean, you could always kind of get the hints of all the diesels running, even though we were isolated well away from it. We couldn't hear it or anything else.
Huh.
But you could pick up, little sniffs of the smell. Because it was exhausted into the air above ground, but our air intake came in from above ground as well. So it doesn't...
So if the wind was blowing the right way, the exhaust would go right into the air intake and you would smell that. That makes sense.
Yeah. Now, they weren't next to each other, but they were not far enough apart that you weren't going to,
right.
If the wind blew the right way, you were going to pick it up.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Huh. What else should I ask you about your time there, not knowing what to ask?
Yeah, like I said, I had, when I got off through, I got into the command post, and I was there just a short time until I qualified, then I was sent to Korea. But my time in the command post was an entirely different situation as far as we were the agency that was the first interface for something bad that would happen at the site. So if something bad happened out there, they would call us first, and then it was up to us to marshal the forces, whatever they might be, to get them help and get things going. So that was kind of the position, as well as a reporting position. Everything that went to higher command came through the wing command post, and there was a wing commander that was a full colonel, and he walked around with the radio 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, ready to be called in if something came up that needed his attention. So,
what kind of thing? What kind of bad thing would happen?
Oh, well, you could have a problem where a guidance system would go down, and they couldn't get it reset or they couldn't get it up. So that meant the missile went off alert.
Oh.
There was a war plan out there that missile is targeted to hit such and such a site at a particular time in the bigger war plan. There was, if you step back just a little bit, there all the nuclear weapons that the U.S. military has, as well as those that our allies at that time, England and France, had, there was a central war plan that said, these missiles will be launched in this sequence to these targets And we have to make sure that we don't blow our other guys' missiles up or airplanes up when that's happening. So if we didn't coordinate, it would be very possible for us to launch a missile and say it was going on its way to Moscow. And at the same time, England had sent Vulcan bombers out of England to hit Moscow. And when we blow up Moscow, we blow them out of the sky. So there was a single integrated operations plan, PSYOP, that integrated all the operations of all the missiles and all the bombers and all the bombs. And we had three potential targets and that we could be launched or told to launch on. And one of them was our primary target. That was if we were ever launched, unless we were told before the launch to change, that's the one we were going to go after. And that was pretty much the way it was for everybody. But if somebody was unable or, you know, for some reason maybe the guidance went down or they had a fuel leak or something else and they had to go off alert, that meant there was a primary target that wasn't that was losing somebody that was supposed to hit it. Now, it might have had two or three other possible ways of getting there. You know, maybe there's a bomber going there as well, some other missiles out of submarines or something. But depending on what the target is, somebody else may have been directed who had a lower priority target to pick up this target until we could get it back on alert. And so one of the big measures for a wing commander was his on-alert time. You know, how many missiles did he have and how much time were they up and ready to go? And he did not want that score to go down. He wanted to keep that score up because that was his evaluation.
Eventually,
that was his job. And so he had the control of not only the crews but also the maintenance people and the other resources that were needed on the base to keep those missiles up and running. So he was kind of the central focal point for measuring that that responsibility, or making sure that his part of the war machine was ready to go. And when one of them would go out, now, we didn't know on crew what our targets were. Somewhere, I would imagine, although I don't know this for certain, there might have been a targeting officer at the wing level, but there wasn't really a need to. The targeting information came on tapes from higher command, and that I was never privy to or didn't have a need to know how that was done. But there was that single integrated operations plan, which was at the highest level, of course, in the Pentagon, but that information for who got what targets and what location, again, that was distributed at a higher level, much higher level than we had any. And we really didn't know. We were trained. It didn't matter what your target was. You didn't know. So there was always this thing, well, what if Captain so-and-so had a second cousin living in Moscow? Would he turn the key to launch the missile if he knew that, and that the target was Moscow? So he didn't know. Didn't have a choice. Wasn't anything to think about. The job was, I don't know what the target is. It's the primary target. I haven't been told to change targets.
Right.
When I turn the key, it's going to go to that target.
Right.
So that part of the information, we didn't know coming down, but we had to tell them on the way on, going back upstream, if we went down for some reason where we weren't going to be able to launch and meet our commitment in the time frame that was required, then we had to tell them immediately, so they could get people back out, get things straightened up, and get us back on alert.
Oh, interesting. Okay. All right. To try to keep all systems going all the time.
Yep. Yeah.
All right. How long were you in wing? Sorry?
Pardon?
How long
there
were
you? There were several things.
No, go ahead.
There were several things that could take you off alert. It wasn't just a missile cell. I mean, communications could be a problem. You know, we had several redundant systems, but they did not want any of our communication systems down because depending on when you explode a nuclear weapon in the air, there's a lot of noise that goes out over the radio frequencies. And depending on, you could knock out, you know, UHF, HF, the very low frequency ones were the hardest ones that they could not probably knock out. But those were also very, very slow. it could take 15 to 20 minutes to get a 30-character message through to us.
Wow. That's really slow.
Yeah. But it was very, it was highly survivable. It was such a low frequency that, you know, the time to get the message through, and that one could actually be transmitted through the earth. It didn't even have to go through the air.
Wow. The frequency is that low. Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know, I want to ask you this, but I'm not quite sure how to frame this. When I think of nuclear weapons, it's not the Minutemen that I worry about. It's some briefcase bomb that some terrorist group's going to get a handle on.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about, you know, the whole concept of nuclear weapons as a deterrent? I can understand that, but, you know, countries come and go. Russia's, you know, gone through some huge changes since the 1960s.
There were nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union that are now, and that was one of the problems when it broke apart, was making sure those were secured in those other countries, or what became other countries that had been part of the Soviet Union. And there was a big program in the 90s, and we literally paid to get some of that stuff back, so that it didn't stay like in the Ukraine, or it didn't stay in Poland, and it didn't stay in East Germany and those places, that they got back either into Russia, or in some cases we bought them and we got them, just to get them, make sure they got out of the hands of anybody else. On the other hand, the technology that developed a nuclear weapon has now become public. I mean, it's hard to hide how you do it. The biggest problem now is isolating the active components, and that's where they come up with this stuff about
centrifuges?
Yes, centrifuges being so important to the process, and they have to be very, very good centrifuges with, you know, the bearings have to be really good and everything else in order to separate the materials that are needed. And that's one prospect, is getting the materials isolated. And the other one is to get a delivery system that will actually work. I mean, our first launches were not very good. So we developed that over a long, long time. So they talk about, like, North Korea having a missile that could reach the United States. Well, technically, they could probably launch a missile and something could possibly land in the United States. But there's a whole bunch of other things that you have to do. One of them is, though the warheads are not light, they're very, very, very heavy. The material that's in that actually makes up the bomb is like lead. It's not lead, but it's very, very dense material.
Okay.
And anything of any size weighs a lot. So you may have a missile that you can boost a basketball up in the air, but getting a nuclear weapon up to do the same thing may be is a much bigger challenge, just the sheer weight of it. The second thing is the accuracy of having a guidance system that can guide it and get it to where it needs to depends, again, on a lot of technology. Now, some of that technology, unfortunately, has slipped away from us and gotten into the hands of the Chinese and the Russians, and I'm sure the North Koreans at this point, so that they have much more accurate weapon systems than they used to have, just because they got their hands on our technology over time. And the other part of it is getting it there and then getting it to survive the reentry. Now, I don't know if you know or not, but what happens is the missile, when it launches, the first stage lasts 2.5 minutes, the second stage lasted 3 minutes, so you had 5.5 minutes of powered flight. The total flight time was about 35 minutes. The rest of it was a ballistic trajectory. You fire a gun, and the bullet comes out of the end of the pistol, and from that point on, it's on a ballistic trajectory. And if you know all the numbers that you need to make the calculation, you calculate, you know, what speed that's coming out and what weight it is, and you can tell the arc that'll go up and where it'll come down.
Mm-hmm.
It's simple if you're shooting from here to, you know, my neighbor's house, and you want to land on their roof. if you want it to land halfway around the world,
right,
while the Earth is turning underneath of it,
that's a complicated arc.
That's a complicated calculation. And
yeah.
I'm not saying that they're not capable of doing that, but it's difficult building equipment that can compensate and do all those things that needs to be done to, when the missile comes out, get it up to enough speed, and so that when it's released, it's going to do that arc appropriately to come down the right place. When it re-enters, when it does that, though, it leaves the atmosphere, and it has to come back down in the atmosphere. And you've been aware of the programs, you know, with manned space, where we came back down and the re-entry vehicles blew up because there was some crack in the heat shields and
right.
things like that.
Right.
Well, you have to have heat shields on nuclear weapons when they re-enter the atmosphere. Well, otherwise, they're going to burn up and fall apart before they ever get to the Earth.
Do they come in nose first, or they come in? I mean, a lot of stuff, the shuttle and whatnot, kind of turns around and backs in, but this, I would assume, would come in nose first.
But they have a huge ablative shield. The whole nose cone and everything behind it, all the way back, is made up of the material. And again, this material is hard to produce, that is made to melt and slough off.
Oh,
And dissipate the heat as it does reenter.
Wow.
And then as it comes back into the atmosphere, it will start to cool down. And that's part of the information that's used, whether it's time to trigger it or not. But again, they need to develop the technology to be able to protect the weapon when it comes back down to reenter the atmosphere.
So, Charlie, I guess I don't, in my naive state here, I don't worry so much about some rogue organization getting and building a rocket to do all this. I just think, all right, well, put the thing in a oil tanker and just steam it into some port somewhere and then explode the thing before you know, the customs people get in there to look around.
Yeah. Well, there are programs, and I don't know how all this stuff works, that monitors the movement of nuclear materials. And I would guess that there's probably something done with satellites.
Okay.
That can monitor or measure that kind of, because they know where it's mined.
Okay.
They know where it's, you know, it comes from and how it moves.
Right.
And there's a signature associated with nuclear material, so that would have to be shielded so it didn't show up.
Set off. Yeah.
You don't need a nuclear weapon to devastate a small city. If you remember, just 2 or 3 years ago, the ship that blew up in the harbor in wasn't Beirut, but it was one of
The ammonium nitrate that blew up in Lebanon.
Yes,
in Beirut.
And
in Beirut, it was a huge amount of ammonium nitrate, fertilizer, which is explosive.
Right. And it devastated, I don't know how many square miles. I mean, there were buildings 2, 3, 4 miles away that just blown apart or blown their windows out, blown the doors off.
Right.
So, I mean, a nuclear one would certainly be capable of doing the same thing, but I don't know how much tracking is done in that case. And even that was an accident. It wasn't on purpose. If somebody was trying to do something purposeful, it could have been much more devastating without having to be nuclear.
Yeah. Okay. Well, fair enough.
To do it with a suitcase is pretty would be pretty difficult. The main reason being the stuff is so damn heavy. And to be of any sizable size and value, they could probably do a pretty dirty atomic bomb we have tactical nuclear weapons that can be launched off of tanks and some other rockets and stuff that they use. They've never been used yet in battle, but they're capable, and they would destroy, you know, a 2 or 3 mile area. And you might be able to get something like that into a fairly good sized suitcase, but I don't think you're going to walk around with a briefcase. You're still not going to light it. And it's going to be dirty, but it's still not the same. When you look at McVeigh and the people in Oklahoma City, I mean, they just drove a truck up to the building and blew the heck out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's hard for me to fathom. How long were you in Wing Command there in Tucson?
Well, I was at the command post for about 6 months, and then once they had job titles that, and this one was Emergency Action Controller, and once I certified in that, then my name went on the list as being a certified Emergency Action Controller, and that particular AFSC or that job at that time was in demand worldwide.
Oh, wow.
And so I was picked up and sent to off of that to Korea because I hadn't been overseas in my 6 years or almost 6 years of service up to that time. So they sent me to Korea, and I worked in a command post in Korea on a Korean Air Force base.
What was that like?
Well, that's a whole nother story. That one, do you remember the, I don't know how old you are, do you remember the Bucher affair and the Pueblo? That was a ship off the coast of Korea, close to North Korea, that was...
it was captured by the North Koreans, wasn't it? Yeah,
right,
the Pueblo.
Captured by North Koreans, and it was brought into a North Korean port, and they held them for, I don't know, 6 or 8 months, 9 months, before they finally sent them back, and they kept the ship and everything else. Well, when that first started, the United States still had a presence in South Korea, but it had really been tuned down quite a bit. And when the Pueblo was grabbed, they wanted to send more aircraft and things like that to South Korea to possibly mount an attack to retaliate and get the U.S. equipment back.
Hmm.
And when they went to do that, they found that they didn't really have any place that to land their aircraft and do the maintenance and everything that they have to do that wasn't occupied and already in use by South Koreans. So as a result of that, they did two things. They built up two bases in South Korea. One of them was down on the southern end of South Korea, and the other one was up close to Osan. And then they also went to a number of South Korean Air Force bases, and they built a command post and taxiways and revetments where they could, if they ever needed to, again, deploy aircraft and the control staff to be able to control aircraft and have a larger presence in South Korea if they ever needed to do that again. But they knew that if they just built it and just said, you know, stay out of there, that wouldn't happen. The South Koreans would move in and take it over and use it. So, and this is what the funny part about it. So what they did was they set up little groups of people at each one of the locations. And I was at one of those locations. It was on Suwon Air Force Base, which is a Korean Air Force Base in Suwon, Korea. And there were about 100 of us. And we were there. The rest of them were there to protect those of us. And there were only like 8 or 9 of us that were working in the command post.
Hmm.
And that was to occupy space so that if they ever had to deploy, they would have a place to put their planes in a command post on all these different places, and they could get there quickly and be ready to go. So for 13 months, my job was to occupy space.
Okay. Occupy space. Hmm.
Right. On a Korean Air Force base to make sure the South Koreans didn't move into it and use it. And most of the time, we didn't do anything. Once in a while, there were two things that would occur once in a while. One of them, we had radio checks, of course. Everybody has radio checks, so it'd be radio checks we'd have to respond to. But the U.S. military, even to this day, flies intelligence gathering aircraft back and forth along the demilitarized zone and off the coast of North Korea.
Okay.
And these airplanes, at that time, there was C-130s. I don't know what they are today, but they have all kinds of antennas on them, and they've got a bunch of people sitting inside who have been trained in Korean and are fluent in Korean and with headsets on, listening to all this communications. So everything that's being broadcast in North Korea is being monitored and taped and recorded and listened to by these people in these aircraft. And the North Koreans are aware of it, so every once in a while they would scramble a couple of airplanes, and they'd come up and they'd come flying towards these guys. And the only defense these guys had was to get down close to the ground and fly as low as they could.
Oh, my God.
as fast as they could. Well, when they did that, they usually ripped off about half of their antennas.
Oh, gee.
And they come in, and so they would need to land somewhere, and they would land once in a while at our at the Suwon Air Force Base, and they would taxi over to our way because they knew that area and they could, you know, they could park, and it was controlled by the U.S. So we had military police that were there with us. They were part of that 100 people there. And they would go out and guard the aircraft and everything, make sure nobody got around it. And these guys would come in, and then another plane would come over, pick them up, fly them back to Japan, because that's where they flew out of. And then somebody would fly one, pick up a plane, take it back to Japan, and refit it, and then they'd put people back in and put them back up, flying back and forth. So every once in a while, we'd get a, you know, call, so-and-so's coming in, they, you know, the North Koreans had scrambled on them, so they're coming in. And then the other one was that about once every quarter, the Marines were stationed in Japan, but the Marines are, were you, I don't know if you had any time in the service or if you've met any Marines, but Marines are probably the epitome of, at that time anyway, the epitome of a soldier in the United States. I mean, they were, everybody knew how to shoot a rifle. Everybody, I don't care if you're a cook or a radio man or a, whatever, everybody could shoot a weapon. Every officer walked into a room, everybody stood up and everything else. And the Air Force was much more casual. And so they would come flying in once in a while, once a quarter, and they would come into our command post and they would set up their communication systems, which were all mobile. It was all on purpose to test their mobility and that they were ready to go whenever the time would come if they had to. And they would set everything up, and they'd be there a week or two, and then they'd pack everything up, and they'd fly back to Japan.
So lots of training for those guys.
That was training for those guys. And for those of us in the Air Force, of course, we're in a command post. And in the command post, you have to pay attention to your displays and your radios and everything else. So when an officer walks in the room, you kind of look, hi, how are you, something like that. You don't just shoot him, unless you're a Marine. And then for them, it was a different story. So the officers didn't like us at all because we would just kind of turn around and nod our head and keep doing what we were doing. And they thought we were being disrespectful. And it was to a certain extent, but it was also just making the light of their, you know,
right.
But they're wound up tight. And they, I'm glad they are. That's
yeah.
what I, one
yeah.
of the things I always told people. I could never be a Marine, but I'm glad
right.
there are people who can.
Right.
Because you need people who are able to respond and do things like that when the time comes.
Right.
So that was kind of my time in South Korea.
And you were there for 6 months?
I came back to Tucson. My then wife was still living here in Tucson. And then after that, when it was time for me to come back about, you know, after I'd been there for 6 or 7 months, I applied for a program in the Air Force called the Airman Education and Commissioning Program. And what it allowed, if you had 2 years of college, you could apply, and if you were accepted, you would be sent to a college, usually one that you could choose or where they had a program, and you would attend the college for 2 years as a regular student. You didn't wear a uniform or anything else. You'd finish your college degree, and then you would go to OCS and go through the Officer Candidate School. And then when that was done, you would be commissioned as an officer in the United States Air Force.
Okay.
So I had my 2 years by that time. I'd taken enough courses and stuff to make it up to 2 years. And I applied, and I was due to come back overseas and go to March Air Force Base and work at a 15th Air Force command post there as an emergency action controller when I was coming back. And so I was coming back, and I had a couple months left on my enlistment that I would have to, that would be completed at March Air Force Base, where the 15th Air Force would be, and then it would be up to me to reenlist at that time. Well, when they know you're coming back and you're short timer, unless you re-up, they said, are you going to reenlist? And I said, am I going to get into this program? And they said, we don't know yet. And I says, well, if you don't know, then I'm going to get out.
Oh.
And that's what happened. I got out. And when I got out, it was in May or June, and I was here in Tucson. And so I just went back down to university and applied to business school and got into the University of Arizona to finish the 2 years and get a degree in accounting and a business degree. But I also walked down to the ROTC building and said, do you have any two-year scholarships available? And they said, are you prior service? And I said, yeah. And they said, yeah, we've got a couple. You want to apply for one? So I applied, and I ended up in a two-year ROTC program, which at that time, it was like you said before, we didn't wear uniforms very much, but it was still it was winding down. Vietnam was pretty much winding down at that point.
This was 1970, 1972 time?
70, let me see, I graduated in 72. So it would have been 72.
Okay.
And so I applied for and got into ROTC and went through that. And my first two semesters, I was a junior. The first semester of my senior year, I was cadet corps commander. And so when it came to the fourth semester, I didn't have to do too much because you're only cadet corps commander for one semester, and then they have a new cadet corps commander each semester. And so I did mine the first part of my senior year. So the last part, they kind of let you're like an advisor to the next guy and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And I was older than all of them at that point in time. Anyway, I was 28 or 29. Let me see, 72, 44. So yeah, 28 at that time.
Okay.
And a lot of them were still.
Yeah, you were an old student.
Yeah, I was an old guy at that time. So, and I was supposed to go to summer camp between my junior and sophomore year, but I broke my ankle out running, trying to get in shape to go. And so I didn't go until after I graduated. Then I went to summer camp and got my commission. And in that interim, I had applied to the Air Force. I applied to at the university they were starting up a program. You get a master's degree in computer science.
Huh.
And they didn't have an undergraduate program at that time. They had a graduate program that was a year or two old. And so I applied for it, and I was accepted. And so I went to the Air Force and said I was accepted because I get a deferment. And they gave me a two-year deferment before I went on active duty. And so I finished my 2 years and got a master's degree in computer science at the university. And, well, 18 months. And then I was finishing up on the 18 months in. The Air Force wanted to reactivate me, and I said, well, how much, you know, what's the option? And they said, well, we are winding down, and we don't need officers as much as we did before. So if you want to get out, you can go on active duty for 6 months, and we'll release you, and then you'll be in the inactive reserves for another 5 years or something like that. And my then wife did not like the Air Force, didn't like the life or anything like that. So it came down to, well, let's look around and see what other jobs there were. And so I did apply for jobs, and I ended up going to work for Bell Labs in Piscataway, New Jersey.
Okay, and, so hang on. Let's clear this up, and then let me look at the time here. Yeah, we should probably start pulling this together. It sounded like to stay as a commissioned officer, you could do 6 months of active duty, and keep your commission.
Right.
But your wife was like, wait a minute, you're gone to Korea and you're here and you're there. You wouldn't just walk away from that. How did that work out? I mean, you could get a job at Bell Labs, fine, but you can't just walk out.
Yeah, it's some people plan their lives out, and I've always admired those people, how they could do that, because mine has always been kind of happenstance. Things happen, and I decide, oh, well, I'll try that. So when it was winding down, one of the things that, and this is true in any military branch, they have two levels of officers. There's a regular and there's what they call reserve, even though it's not a reserve like you think of the reserves. So if you can be in the regular military, regular Army, Air Force, Navy, any of them, and you could be a reserve officer or a regular, your commission is either a reserve commission or a regular commission.
Okay.
A reserve commission, you can be told tomorrow, we don't need you anymore, see ya. a regular commission is kind of like the core. Those are the people that, come hell or high water, are going to be in the military. They're going to stay there. They're never going to be told to leave unless they physically or fail or,
right.
or really mess something up.
Right.
But it's the core. If you get a regular commission, that's kind of like having tenure, I guess, is the closest thing I can
yeah.
call.
Yeah.
And when you, the only people who get regular commissions right out of the box are the graduates from the academies. So if you graduate from the Air Force Academy, you get a regular commission out the door.
Okay.
Anybody through ROTC or anything like that, you get a reserve commission.
Got it.
Down the road, they can offer you a regular commission.
Okay.
But if you don't get that regular commission, you could be, you kind of serve as they see Steve Schitt. And that was one of the things that was kind of up in the air. You know, if I went back in, that would still be with a reserve commission, and they were winding down in Vietnam, that meant they were going to be getting rid of a lot of officers, and the regular Corps was going to be what was going to be left, plus some reserve.
Right, now, got it. So they said you could do active duty for 6 months and then be on 5 years of reserve with no ability to go regular.
Without knowing whether, I mean, it
right.
could have been down the road, I could have been selected and be given a regular commission.
Huh.
But there was no guarantee.
Got it.
And
there were a lot of officers coming out of Vietnam, and it was like, okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it wasn't that difficult, especially there was a lot of pressure at home to,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't want to be moving around the world. I mean,
so how did you affect a graceful exit?
How did I do what?
How did you affect a graceful exit?
They basically gave me the option.
Oh, okay.
They said, you know, you can do 6 months and get out, or you can stay around and, you know, your reserve commission, and you can stay, and we'll send you so-and-so, or these will be your jobs, and, you know, maybe you'll stay in the Air Force, maybe you won't.
Got it. So the option was 6 more months and you don't need to re-enlist, and you can be...
You're done.
You're done.
Your second's yeah. done.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
And they did give me that 2-year deferment, but they never paid any of my... Well, I shouldn't take that back. During ROTC, I did get a $200 a month or something like that while I was in ROTC. That was part of the, you know, that was part of the 2-year scholarship that I got from them. It was so many dollars a month. But I worked in... had a GI Bill at that time. So between working, GI Bill, and my wife working, you know, that was what we lived on during that time. And then, including when I went to graduate school. Now, at graduate school, I didn't get the ROTC pay anymore. I was already commissioned. But they did give me that 2-year deferment. And the thing I think that no one ever kept records very well at that time, and there was a lot of other things going on, but I had an accounting degree when I graduated, when I finished my bachelor's.
Right.
But when I went to graduate school, I was working on a computer science degree. And when I finished that, I had a master's in computer science. Now, I can't imagine the Air Force was going to let me go that easy with that degree. But when I saw my paperwork and I signed out, they still had me down as having a finance degree.
Oh, wow.
And not having that. So I don't know whose responsibility was or anything else, but I didn't argue. I just walked out the door and went on to work at Bell Labs.
Had you lined that Bell Labs job up before?
When they gave me the option, they gave me some time. I didn't have to make a decision right away. So, and I also had that 6 months where I was on active duty. So I mm-hmm. I had completed my master's degree, and I applied at quite a few places. And the one at Bell Labs, two reasons. It was decent money, but it's a prestige place to work. If you've got Bell Labs on your resume, going no matter what you do at that time, at least in the future, that's one of the best places to work in the United States at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
Bell Labs invented the laser, they invented the transistor, they invented all kinds of stuff.
Yeah,
Bell Labs, it doesn't have that same connotation today, but at that time, it was one of the best places you go to work. And, you know, I was going in at the bottom, but excuse me, it was still a place from prestige point of view that I wanted to be able to go to work at. And it was way above me. I mean, these people, I mean, there are people that you meet sometimes and you're just amazed, or at least I was amazed, how smart they were, how much they knew, and how they could think. And I thought, you know, this is a good job.
Yeah.
But I hate New Jersey.
Hey, Charlie, you know, let's... I want to know a little bit more about Bell Labs, but we've been going here for a while.
Sure.
Maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this interview series, and we'll take it up next time with Bell Labs.
Sure. Yeah.
Is there anything you'd like to add in the material that we've covered today that I didn't ask you about?
I guess the only thing I would say is a lot of people have said to be, you know, especially now, because the military doesn't play much in most people's lives, you know, did I regret the military or anything like that? And I can't say that I did. Everything that happened to me in the military was very positive.
Uh-huh.
I got great education. I got great opportunities as far as jobs and things like that. My assignment to Korea was my first time outside of the United States in a country that was, at that time, you could definitely say it was third world. So I saw all kinds of things that just kind of woke you up, you know, that when people complain, I'm going off on a tangent here, but when people complain about how hard life is here,
right,
and you saw some guy whose job is to scoop the crap out of a outside latrine, and you think, your job.
And put it on a hand cart and push it away, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And push it down the street and spread it in the field.
Right.
Your job isn't bad at all.
Correct.
So anyway. That, I think, I had such great opportunities, and even the ROTC program, the fact that I got in there and they helped pay for it along with the GI Bill, I probably would have never finished my college anywhere, if I ever did, is anywhere near as fast as I did when I got out, just because I didn't have to worry a lot about money, between the GI Bill and the ROTC,
right,
and my wife working in my job part-time, those all helped. Money on the table. We were never really, you know, hand to mouth or anything like that. Right. And
I didn't ask you, so what was your part time job?
I worked in a parts store on 22nd Street, just a little bit west of Craycroft, called Hanson's
Auto Parts.
And yep, auto parts store. Yeah, it was. That's a whole nother story. It was the first time I met the guy. I've always. When I grew up a time when kids did hot rodding on cars and stuff like that. So I've always been into cars. I still right now have a 1955 Thunderbird and a 1956 Ford sitting in my garage.
Oh, my gosh.
I never got away from playing with cars amongst all my other things. But
what kind of Ford do you have?
I have a 1955 Ford Thunderbird.
Okay. That's
and
lovely.
And then I have a 1956 Ford two-door sedan.
What's the two-door sedan called?
It's called a custom line. In those days, they made Fairlanes and a few other models of their sedans, but this is a custom line, and it's the lightest of the Ford cars of that year. And neither one of them are restored. They're both hot rods.
Oh, okay. All right.
They're heavily modified for, you know, making a lot of noise and going fast, but right. Not very.
Sorry, I digress, because those mid-50s Fords are not very attractive. Most people want to go for the Chevys, and but they're really neat. I think. Wait a minute, those Ford sedans are they look kind of cop car-ish, sort of rounded back and rounded front, but they're very okay, very cool. Sorry, I digress.
That's okay. Anyway, I had always worked on cars and stuff. So when I was looking for a full-time job, when I was in the service, even before I got out to go to college and stuff, was I had worked in retail at a stocking shelves and all those kind of things. I worked in a gas station down on Broadway, and but I had an old Ford, a 49 Ford Coupe.
Wow!
And it had a flathead V8, and the guy Hanson had a place on Campbell, just north of Grant, that was a hot rod shop, and he had in there a set of aluminum heads that I lusted after for probably 18 months before I saved enough money to be able to buy them.
Huh.
Well, then when I got out of, when I finished my bachelor's and I went to get my master's, I was looking for a job again, and he had moved, he had closed that store and he'd moved up on 22nd Street. And I went in and told him, you know, that I had bought these heads and stuff. And I said, you had a sign in, are you looking for some help? He says, yeah, but you got to work nights. Well, that worked perfect for me. Because I was going to school at the university and I could work, you know, from 6 in the evening till 10 and close the place down. And so that's what I did.
You could do your homework.
And I could do homework because a lot of times at night at those stores, they weren't very busy. So,
yeah.
And we had a desk down below the counter so I could do homework there. And but the good thing was he had all these old, old parts,
wow.
You know, things that nobody carried anymore. So if somebody needed an old part, they knew where they were going to go and they came in. But he knew he had them, and he never sold anything at a discount when it was an old part. You were going to play
full price,
top down old part. But anyway, that was the sideline.
Huh.
That was where I worked, though, for the 2 years when I was working, or the 18 months I worked on my master's degree.
Oh, very
he
cool.
was a great old guy. He, you know, like I told you, I met him or knew of him from when I bought those heads. But when I went to work for him, I mean, he was kind of an old grouchy codger and stuff like that. But he was really very nice to his employees and really did well by us. So,
nice. What was his first name?
You know, I wish I could remember.
Okay.
I just don't. But it was Hanson's Auto Parts. Yeah.
Nice. Well, Charlie, thank you so much for your service and, you know, to the country in a very important position. And thank you for this interview today. This will go ahead and conclude part two of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Charlie Schultz. Today is Friday, February 17th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Charlie, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.